Chair.
The meeting of the Subcommittee for Criminal Records Relief will come to order. And we don't quite have a quorum yet, so we're going to start, if it's okay, with Representative Clark. Are you prepared to proceed? And just to note for the record, Edwin, first off, these are informational hearings that we're having. We can discuss more of the specifics on each bill, but for now, Representative Clark is prepared to discuss hers. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I do appreciate the chance to have this hearing, even though it is informational only. The issue of having evictions expunged from tenant records is kind of a long one, and I was talking with Mr. Horner a little bit earlier. We've gone back and forth over the years with some of these issues. And I'm hoping that what we can do today is, again, just take a few moments and highlight the issue, the concerns that are related to it. I've asked Ron Elwood to join me from Legal Services. Over the years, we've worked together on a lot of issues that have to do with tenants' rights. And we have some very serious issues around people having an eviction that stays with them really pretty much for the rest of their life if it's ever happened once for any number of reasons. And so while there's, you know, there's a good reason to have some of this information available, on the other hand, it can be abused. And so I wanted to ask Mr. Elwood to provide a little bit of background as well, Mr. Chairman. And I'm hoping that what we might do is begin to move the process off the dime where it's been sitting for a few years, and so I appreciate this hearing.
Thank you, Representative Clark. Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and member. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. This has certainly been an issue of great interest to our clients for as long as we've been in existence, which is quite some time. As you well know, having an eviction record, having an eviction on your record is kind of like wearing a big scarlet letter around your neck forever. It never goes away. There certainly is a statute that provides for expungement. It's section 484.014. The standards under that particular statute are fairly rigid. The case has to be sufficiently without basis in law or fact, and then the court does a balancing test to determine whether the public interest, the interest of justice in expunging a record, is not outweighed by the public's interest in the right to know about the eviction. And while we're pleased to have that option in statute, I think it's frankly too narrow and doesn't provide the opportunity for folks who may have had questionable evictions. I mean, there are certainly clear-cut examples where a record probably should be there and follow that person forever, a serious violent crime committed or something of that nature. But then there's a lot of gray in between, and I don't think our statutes acknowledge that. And at this point, the tie always goes against the tenant. There is no opportunity really to get beyond that record, and we all know it would be one thing if in the real world somebody's eviction record was not effectively a bar to housing, but we do know that it is, and circumstances are often far from clear. For example, there could have perhaps been at least in part a retaliatory eviction. However, the facts in the case, the plaintiff either wasn't able to prove that, or the plaintiff had no counsel. Many, many, many times tenants will be coming to court without counsel and not even understanding what their rights are. So to have this thing hanging around your neck and preventing you from getting housing forever seems to be extreme. And I think what we really need to do is figure out a way to get somewhere between having this on your record forever and never. So there's some middle ground that we need to reach, And I would be happy to work with Representative Clark and anyone else, certainly Mr. Horner and any other interested parties, to try to figure out a better way to give people a second chance and be able to get housing in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Are there questions for Mr. Elwood or Representative Clark on this? Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question that I would have is, I've done, with my other job at the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, which I'm not speaking for them, by the way, but my experience has been regarding unlawful detainers and eviction notices, that you have various reasons for why you can be evicted. Weapons, violence, drugs, prostitution. Does your bill, Representative Clark, specify which unlawful detainers or eviction notices or evictions would be expunged? I mean, if you were mistaken or it was your roommate that damaged the place, but you both got evicted and now you're both in trouble where it was your roommate's fault. I mean, I think there's a big difference, and I think this is what you're alluding to, that there's a gray area here. But I don't disagree that there is an issue when it comes to expungement and criminal records for people getting jobs, people getting proper housing. But I would like to take a look at, Mr. Chair, and maybe this is something we can do next session, but I would really like to have the courts in here to explain the whole process for a committee and then explain if they feel that there are other areas that we can be done, if there's another mechanism that can be done to not do a blanketing expungement of criminal records for any reason, but to have a more efficient process for expungement. But I guess I went on my soapbox here, but my question is, does your bill, Representative Clark, specify the types of evictions that would be expunged?
Representative Clark.
No, it clearly does not, and that's one of the flaws of it. And we were just talking earlier about, I see this as just a beginning step, maybe to get a, you know, maybe a working group or something together, you and others would be interested. I think trying to explore the gray area is a good way to talk about it, and I'd be very interested in that, because I think, you know, landlords need to be able to know when there's certain issues of violence and others that would be the source of a eviction. On the other hand, many of these gray areas, especially, you know, one of the things I'm really worried about now is what's happening with some of the issues around foreclosure and you know, tenants who are finding themselves in pretty difficult situations right now. At any rate, I'd like to, the answer to your question is no, it doesn't specify that, but I think it could, and when we get to a bill that's actually going to be moving forward, I'd like to do that.
I would also note, to that point, for members of the audience, these are informational hearings, and the intention is that over the course of the interim, or even immediately after this and prior to the start of the interim, that working groups begin on these issues. These are issues that we have grappled with over the course of the past couple of sessions, and even longer, I guess. And this committee meeting, this meeting of the subcommittee, will precipitate many discussions about the language of these particular bills, and we anticipate that there will be action on them relatively soon, next session. So thank you for the answer, Representative Clark. Are there other questions for Mr. Elwood or Representative Clark? I do have a question, Representative Clark. Representative Dominguez's bill was similar to this and went through Representative Mulder's committee and was not that well received. It was a year, though, and I wonder if you can describe, or Mr. Wood, the differences between your bill and Representative Dominguez's bill, and if it is just a 1-2 year thing, why did you pick 2 years?
I guess the 2 year question is for me, and then maybe I'll ask Mr. Elwood if he wants to just say anything more about the difference between the two bills, because I'm not on that committee and I don't know specifically what all that bill was. I think this seemed like some sort of reasonable beginning stage. He had 1 year, this is 2 years. I don't know what the magic number is. I think it's probably not so much the number of years, although that's part of it. I think it also are some of the conditions that I think Representative Bingham was bringing up, combination. So I do want to say that there's a very serious problem out there. We have many people who are unable to get housing and they're homeless because of the issue that happened with an eviction. Sometimes, you know, prisoners particularly had lost their job or had a medical emergency. There can be a lot of reasons why people don't pay their rent and lose their housing. And so, well, there can be other things, too. I mean, we certainly over the years have had tenants who've refused the advances of a landlord, for example, and then found themselves evicted for that reason, and they ended up, you know, having a hard time getting housing because of that. So, I mean, there's many, many different things, and I guess I don't have a specific magic number. I do think that combining a reasonable amount of time with some other qualifying factors would be a good place to start.
Thank you, Representative Clark. Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and members, I think the concept is that right now the expungement is there forever. And the presumption, there's a presumption there inherent in that, which is if you fail to pay your rent once, then you're prone to do it again. But that would be the same thing as saying, you know, if you get a speeding ticket once or you made an illegal left turn once, then that should be on your license for the rest of your life because you're prone to speed. I mean, you know, you could say this is very similar to that in that, you know, your driving record stays on for a certain number of years, and then if you are, your driving record is clean, it just goes off because the presumption is that you will be a good driver and not a bad driver. But this is the reverse. And I think the concept here is to suggest that if the offense that led to the eviction, you know, was not serious, as some of the things that Representative Bingham was pointing out, then why should the presumption be that that person is never ever going to pay their rent again and therefore never be able to get housing? So I think, you know, if we start at that point, I mean, the current law is very, very punishing. And I'm not sure that that's the public policy that is in the best interest of the state of Minnesota, and certainly not in the best interest of individuals who may once have had a problem and now would be fine, but for the fact that they have this scarlet letter hanging on them for the rest of their lives.
Mr. Chair and Michelle would... But when you get a speeding ticket, your insurance company finds out and the insurance rates go up. When you don't pay your mortgage or when you're late on a bill, your credit rating goes down. We have mechanisms in there to protect those for the examples and the one I added on. I don't disagree that there is an issue. There is an issue. But I also am of the opinion that when you have a property or employer, they, you know, to a point have a right to know a lot of these issues to let them determine the risk that they're willing to take. I know these are informational hearings and I don't want to take up any more time, Mr. Chair, but I think this goes to the bigger discussion of what is good policy to do. And having blanketed automatic eviction or expungements, in my opinion, is also not the best policy. So I think that this working group, and as we work through the interim and into next session, that is going to be a very good discussion and one that is very merited.
Thank you, Representative Bingham. If there are no other questions for the testifiers, I believe we have other people willing to testify in the audience. If so, would you please come forward? Thank you, Representative Clark. And Representative Clark, do you have to leave, as you said?
I'm waiting to be called back for
a moment. Okay, I got you. Okay. Okay. And Mr. Horner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jack Horner, representing Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. Mr. Chairman and members, as the chairman pointed out, a very similar bill was heard at some length just 2 weeks ago, and so in the interest of time, I will not recap all the discussion, but I'd be more than happy to respond to any questions or concerns. I would like to just make a couple of points, though, in the interest of information. First of all, past performance is, of course, a indication of what a person might do or might be likely to do, and it's very important that landlords know, for two reasons, what the credit history and the rental history of their renters is. First of all, we talked about foreclosures. The issue came up. Well, I mean, a fundamental issue of any kind of good credit management, avoiding foreclosure, is to have paying customers in. You have to make sure that your customers, in fact, are willing and able to pay the bill, and that their history shows that they'll pay the bill. Otherwise, you really do just exacerbate foreclosure problems by getting residents into neighborhoods who have a history of not paying the bill. And that puts the building in jeopardy, and it puts the building, the owner, more likely to have to vacate for a proper degree foreclosed. Secondly, the kinds of UDs, unlawful detainers, the old term, evictions is the new term for years now. Evictions also have to do with lease violations, law violations, landlord-tenant statute that makes various kinds of criminal activity, drugs, of course, the prostitution, guns, fencing, stolen property, and so on, automatically lease violations, and so there are evictions for this kind of thing as well. Again, very important that the law allow landlords to screen for the purpose of protecting the other tenants, for the neighborhood, the well-being of the cities in which the property is located. Mr. Chairman, two other points finally. There is already a lot of law on this topic. The Fair Credit Reporting Act, the Federal Fair Credit Reporting Act, defines a renting as a credit transaction. And so it comes under all the credit laws that we already have in place, both national and at the state level. So basically, we're talking 7 years for credit information. As I mentioned earlier, there are some exceptions. Bankruptcies are 10 years. Civil judgments, as we all know in Minnesota, are good for 10 years. But generally speaking, 7 years is kind of the limit. Expungements, evictions also disappear on court records in the ordinary course of record maintenance and of file maintenance. So it's not quite accurate to say they're with you forever. They're with you according to the national standards, according to long-established practice. They don't stay with you forever. We do have in Minnesota an expungement law. Hundreds of UDs, evictions, are expunged every year, ones that are meritless or have no particular reason for being there. Just this year, the legislature is going to pass a new expungement law specifically addressing foreclosures. So we address issues that come up in a narrow way without wiping out all information necessary to know. We agreed with that. We agree that in the case of foreclosures, there are evictions that ought not to be on a tenant's record. And in fact, they will be automatically expunged, and we agree with that. One of the speakers mentioned retaliation. Well, again, in Minnesota statute, there's a presumption against retaliation. If a landlord terminates a tenancy within 90 days, there's various parameters, but the basic concept is that it's not up to the tenant to have to prove it. The landlord has to prove he didn't retaliate. So the law is actually on the side of the tenant in that case. One final point, the Supreme Court's rules of public access to records, strong presumption of public knowledge, public right to know, directs the courts to put both on-site and off-site information about judgments and court actions available to the people. I mean, getting to a more philosophical point of view, it's extremely important that the citizens know what the courts are doing. We don't want hidden courts and secret court actions and that kind of thing. So, Mr. Chairman, we do respectfully oppose this bill. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Horner?
No. I do have a question, Mr. Horner. You represent Minnesota Multi-Housing. What is the median number of units owned by a typical client of yours?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have that number. We do tend to be the larger buildings. We are a statewide organization. We've had 2,300, I think, members now currently. I'm not that close. We have several hundred smaller members, but people who own 1, 2, 3 units. We encourage them to join. We want them to join. But the fact is, the practicality is that the majority of our members tend to be a little bit larger, own a building of, say, 20 units up or 100 units, or, of course, in some cases, thousands of units, the large management company. But I don't have a median number, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Horner. The reason I asked is that I wonder, you come in here and testify about these things, and sometimes we hear from landlords and sometimes we don't. And I know it's the position of multi-housing that you're presenting in the interest of your clients. And I find myself oftentimes wondering,
what's going on in the minds of many of the landlords who have the one or two or three units or whatever. I have been a landlord, one of those landlords, going on 10 years now of four units, and I have never had to file an eviction or a UD, and I don't know how typical that is. At all.
Really. Good management, I think.
Well,
Chairman.
Maybe I'm just lucky, but I have had to kick people out and sue them for back rent, but I've never actually had to file an eviction such that it would affect their record in this situation. And so I find myself wondering, okay, how many other landlords are there out there in my position, and you representing some of the larger units, obviously if I had a 100-unit building or even a 30-unit building, I'm guessing I wouldn't be in that situation because I wouldn't be able to be as hands-on. I would have to manage it with economies of scale. So I wondered if there's an opportunity and next time to bring in some of these landlords. And I know I personally would like to hear from some of the smaller landlords, too, because I would wager that they own or manage the majority of rental units in the state of Minnesota. So just to put that out there.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. and certainly we can do that. We have done that. We've had landlords, small landlords in Minneapolis and St. Paul on other issues and other bills. We are in touch with a lot of small landlords. I personally speak to a lot of groups. There's a lot of landlord organizations, an excellent one in St. Paul, Minneapolis, the Arrowhead one in Duluth, the Mankato, St. Cloud, Rochester, I could go on. I mean, just about every area has a landlord's group, and they do tend to be the smaller properties. And we are in touch with them. We meet with them. We had a statewide convention just a couple of weeks ago with HUD and NARO and MHSA and ourselves, and landlords of all kinds, stripes, assisted, large, small, come to meetings like that. So we do make an effort. So we are in touch with a lot of landlords, and we do take their pulse. We do talk to them, and they talk to us. So it's true that our members are tend to be, not at all exclusively, but tend to be the larger, but we are in touch. We do claim, and I think quite accurately, that we represent all landlords in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Horner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other testifiers in the audience on this House File 2331? That being the case, and there being no motion, there will be no movement on this bill. And as stated, it is the chair's anticipation that there will be working groups publicized and noticed to people in the coming months. Now, Representative Mullery, he's still on his other bill down there? Okay. So what we'll do is the committee will recess for 10 minutes to determine the status of Representative Mullery and his other bill.
Mr. Chairman, meeting of Criminal Records Subrelease
Subcommittee is reconvened. Representative Mullery, thank you for gracing us with your sweater.
Are you blind this way?
And Representative Mullery, the chair moves House File 3407, and I believe you have, or do you have, an amendment as passed by the Senate?
I don't have that amendment. I have a copy, which I have not read. I just received it.
Well, we do. Representative Mullery, would you like to offer that?
No.
We're calling the A1 amendment?
No, Mr. Chairman. I don't want it on the bill because I have not studied it and
okay.
All the consequences of it, so I would oppose it.
Great. Then we would move House File 3407 and to your bill as moved, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Right. And I would state also, if I could, that it's the chair's intention to lay this over, just to be clear. So, and that's your desire as well, or some
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My understanding was that it was an informational hearing on this, and I wanted to thank you for holding these informational hearings on this issue. The whole issue of arrest records and conviction records needs to be explored thoroughly, and it's really complicated and not to be done without a study on all the issues. many of us, at least a few of us, are working extensively on the whole issue of reentry. And but the important things are, for instance, job training, employment skills, job placement, treatment of the 60-80% of prisoners who have mental illness or drug addiction, probation supervision to make sure people don't get back into the lifestyle or with the same type of people that got them into trouble. And the issue of criminal records is minor, but also is an important part of the whole reentry issue in some cases. And this bill doesn't get into the issue of convictions. It does take a somewhat a unique approach from the other bills we're seeing as far as expungement. This one takes a different approach, and I think its originators for this new approach, what it does is it basically says if you employ somebody with a record of arrests, etc., criminal complaints, that you can't be held liable for that. They're immune from civil liability for negligent hiring or employing a person with that. And there are some issues that are still not addressed in this bill, such as what about a John Gotti situation where the person was arrested for killing hundreds of people. There was clear proof he got off because of intimidating jurors. The O.J. Simpson's another case, a drug dealer with 100 arrests for loitering to sell drugs on 26th and Knox in North Minneapolis. What do we do with those situations? There's also an issue of if we are endangering other employees, which is the argument against doing something like this, and we're saying that, okay, we're willing as a society to endanger the other employees, the slight amounts that there might be for good of society as a whole, should it be society as a whole, then that pays that victim if there is a victim. In other words, if there are victims, and they would normally have a right against the employer, if we're going to say for the good of society they can't sue the employer, should society then step up as a state or whatever to pay, for instance, the medical costs of that victim or whatever? So that has to be also looked into. And also we should look into, should the state give a tax break or something for hiring such people? But I think it's really good to get this out in the open in front of your committee. And I do have a witness from the group that developed this bill, and I'd like to have them present their side. And then if anybody else wants to testify as to problems with the bill, and I've mentioned some of the problems that have to be worked out before we can get into putting this into law. And again, I thank you for looking into this important issue. But there's a Mark Hasse from Council on Crime and Justice, I believe.
Thank you, Representative Mullery. And before Mr. Hasse introduces himself and speaks for the record, we do have a question from Representative Colt.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, and I appreciate the chance just to raise the issue before the testifier speaks, because maybe this is going to be part of his comments, or he can make it part of his comments. But two other issues, I guess, as I think about this, and I haven't given it a lot of thought to be completely candid, but if I'm a financial services firm and I'm looking to hire somebody, I may have some licensing requirements with regard to fraud arrests or things of that nature. And even if I didn't have licensing requirements, I may want to know that if somebody is going to be entrusted with either my resources as a corporate entity, or even more significantly, the resources of a depositor at a bank or a brokerage house or whatever the case may be, if I'm going to have access to financial resources. That would be one issue that I think, and I realize we're laying this over, that's an issue that I think needs to at least be addressed and fleshed out before we move forward on this. The other thing that I don't think I heard you mention and that I would have a concern of, it's not just other employees who could potentially be impacted, but if customers or people who are working with children are vulnerable adults, I don't want to go there. We just had the discussion down in finance, but if somebody has a violent background or several arrests for sexual abuse or something like that, and they're going to be working with children, I think there's good reason to make sure that employers have the ability to ask those questions, at least, and need to be informed. And maybe, I know that the bill says, if there's another requirement that they find that, or I believe it says, unless specifically required or permitted by statute. So maybe we can address some of those concerns there. But those are a couple issues that I just kind of wanted to put on the table as we move this forward.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Cole, thank you. That's my intent for trying to get this out and get as much. I didn't cover the customers, but I believe that also in the bill they're treated the same way as other employees, I believe. Mr. Hossie can talk to that. And I think there probably is a good reason maybe to look at the type of arrest it was, whether or not it ties in closely, and that's what we have to look at on a lot of the other bills that are coming around on this case, as we have to look at it in the whole issue of what the state is, as you know, has barred people with a felony from working in all kinds of areas, which doesn't make sense. For instance, if you have a DUI, why can't you work in the financial services area or something? So, Mr. Chairman, I totally agree with Representative Coles that all these things have to be looked at.
Thank you, Representative Mulley. Mr. Hossie, please state your full name and introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Mark Hossie, last name spelled H-A-A-S-E, and I am the advocacy coordinator and staff attorney for the Council on Crime and Justice. And I will disclose that the council played a role in drafting this legislation, working closely with Senator Mula and the Senate on it. Let me first say that this bill is an attempt at addressing a huge issue, a looming issue that is starting to be recognized, I think, fortunately, at the national level as well as the state level. Minnesota has the Minnesota prison population has doubled in the last 10 to 15 years, similar figures for nationally. And may I suggest, with all due respect, that I think this issue needs to start being, although it's an issue of human rights and justice, it needs to start to be framed as a public safety issue. Because if people who have records, people who have had contact with the criminal justice system, are not given a chance to work, to find housing, it's going to become a larger and larger public safety issue. So in that light, I think that the council and others have worked really hard to find some legislation that would be very narrowly tailored and reasonable given the concerns that are out there. And let me also clarify, I think Representative Mulderry did this, but this particular legislation is not an expungement bill. It's not a record sealing bill. All the records are still out there, which is maybe a separate issue to be dealt with, but this is one way of, like Representative Mulderry said, approaching it from a little bit of a creative position. There are two primary parts of the bill, and they are pretty distinct. It's easy to get them mixed up, but it's important to keep them separate. The first is the one that prohibits private employers from using arrest records in hiring. And actually, the term is non-conviction records. And this part of the bill actually just takes a public law that already exists that applies to public employers and applies it to private employers. Now, note that it applies to employers, not employees, not volunteers. It doesn't apply to landlords, people checking on records for people they might date online, those types of things. And a real important note is that it's for non-conviction records. And the definition of non-conviction record is a record of arrest, citation, complaint, prosecution, or other record that is not pending and did not result in a conviction. So if somebody had a pending arrest, something was going on currently, an employer could use that. And a current, an employer of a current employee could also use that. And then, you know, another concern that's been brought up, Representative Coles, which I think this addresses your concern somewhat, the language that states, unless specifically required or permitted by statute. And there's a whole list of statutes that currently exist that make using arrest records either optional or required. And I don't know if the members have this memo from the council. On the back is a list of all those types of positions. So that includes people who do mortgages, financial workers, school bus drivers, taxi drivers, volunteers and employees in schools. It's a very comprehensive list that I do think addresses a lot of the concerns about vulnerable adults, children, financial issues. So again, I think this is a real, you know, narrow reasoned way of starting to address the fact that there's thousands of Minnesotans out there who have had contact with the criminal justice system. They were not proven guilty. And to, you know, go to the example of John Gotti or O.J. Simpson. One, you know, a response to that would be that employees have to do more than just do background checks, do criminal background checks. They have to check references. They have to make sure there's a credible work history. And I think given that, they probably wouldn't hire O.J. Simpson or John Gotti, at least not in most positions. Now, moving on to the second part of the bill. This is, in the current House version, it's called immunity from civil liability. In the more recent Senate version, we called it an affirmative defense. And what that means is really a civil immunity from liability is an affirmative defense. And we thought that the language in the Senate that we have now is a little more precise. Basically, it doesn't change current for negligent hiring liability. It gives, if the employer has either made sure that the offense doesn't relate to the employment, so it couldn't be somebody, you know, employed in a daycare center who had some type of sexual offense in the past, or they've seen that the person's been rehabilitated. And the law references the public statute, which lists different ways you can check rehabilitation. If the employer has done those two things, this law would provide them with a step up in litigation. So in other words, if somebody sued them, they could come in earlier in the lawsuit, and they could prove by clear and compelling evidence, I'm sorry, by the preponderance of the evidence that they had done these things, they might not have to go all the way to litigation. So, and really what it is, I think, is another way that the council is trying to approach this issue is through education. We have a program called GAGE, gaining access to useful and gainful employment. And what we're doing there is going out to employers and saying, instead of just doing background checks of everybody that comes in, find out who's qualified, then do a criminal background check, and then let the person explain it, you know, and be more discriminatory in how you use criminal background checks. And I feel that this law would sort of help in that public education and give a little bit of a carrot. You know, other states have said, if you don't do this, you know, if you don't properly, if you use conviction records improperly, you're going to be penalized. Instead, what we're trying to do here is say, do the right thing, and you're going to have a little bit of a protection from liability. I think that's the bulk of my testimony, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hussey. Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a few questions. How would this affect diversion programs or CWAPs, continuing without probation? I mean, the employer would not even be able to know, as this is written right now, if I swindled a check for less than $5,000 in Hennepin County and I was put on probation or on de novo program or diversion, and they would not be able to know that according to your bill right now, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Friedman, thank you. You know, if they weren't convicted, which I believe would be the case in that situation, then they would, you know, this law would prohibit them from using that record, unless there is a statute that already permits it, but I don't know in that case if there would be.
Mr. Chair, de novo, you actually admit the crime, but they puts you, they don't recognize it, but you actually sign it. So if you fail out of a program, then you have to fulfill your terms of a conviction. The other, so again, I that wouldn't be eligible in your program. So somebody who is on a diversion program or de novo program, they still wouldn't know about that, including through this bill. So that kind of,
well, let me clear, Representative Mulready. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Bingham. I think that that's a point that I brought up to them earlier, is, and all of, a lot of these bills treat what you're talking about as if there was a basically no adjudication or anything. Even if you've pled guilty and it's stayed, or you pled guilty and you're put into a diversion program under a lot of these bills, and I believe this one, you would not be treated as having been convicted, or in essence you're treated as there's no record whatsoever, which is...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other question I have is, a lot of times when there are multiple charges or multiple accounts, and maybe Mr. Chair can chime in on this part, there's plea bargains or plea agreements that are dealt with where, let's say you have a, I'm going to just pick two charges, criminal damage to property and theft, and they dismiss one of the theft, let's say, but they convict you of criminal damage to property. So if I was an employer and I ran the background, I would see, oh, well, he got a little rowdy, or she got a little rowdy, so they got a they have a criminal damage to property. But under your bill, as a banker employer, I would never know about the theft, or, you know, check forgery, whatever the charge, you know, whatever the second charge is. So, is there anything in this bill that would resolve a scenario like that?
Mr. Mulready or Mr. Rossi?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bingham, one response to that, the response, I think it's no as far as does the bill address it, but again, I think we have to look at how are the employers screening employees, and if they saw in there that there was a, you know, a disorderly conduct or something that wasn't theft, had been reduced, whether that was there or not, they should be checking into work history and checking references and those types of things. So my response would be that maybe they, you know, they did do that, they weren't convicted of it, they pled to something else, but, you know, they've had a work history since then that makes them, you know, potentially a trustworthy employee. I guess that's the same response for the other scenario, and also with the cases of diversion when there's nothing on their record. My experience has been, you know, I've worked in the Ramsey County Attorney's Office in felony sentencing for a brief period, and the cases that are allowed that are pretty, you know, it's a pretty small number, and there's pretty narrow circumstances in that case.
I also know, okay, you know, when prosecutors decide to charge these things based off of police reports or whatever, we'll try to get as many charges as we can in there. And also, one of the things we try to default to is we attempt to get crimes of dishonesty as convictions, because that results in further ability to impeach in subsequent trials. And so we default in favor of crimes of dishonesty, including theft. Although I would note that the Court of Appeals has determined that basic shoplifting does not qualify as a crime of dishonesty, which is interesting, which we cannot use for impeachment. However, the question that I had for the testifiers includes and does relate to this issue, which has been the prevailing area of questioning here on the idea of it being a non-conviction record. In the courts now, when you enter a plea on the record, that is generally considered to be the area where it counts as a conviction. And then the court is free to decide how, in fact, they're going to use it. So no plea entered on the record is considered a state of adjudication, which, however, is reversible error if it's objected to by the state. And when you, in fact, do get a conviction on the record, the court is free to decide they're going to give a stay of imposition of sentence, which is where my question comes in. If you are convicted of a felony, but are granted a stay of imposition, and by virtue of a certain period of time elapsing, it then becomes a gross misdemeanor. Or a gross misdemeanor, when you're given a stay of imposition sentence, becomes a misdemeanor. How does this bill impact that? Because if I'm looking for, if I'm out there and I say, I don't want any felony theft, I don't want to hire anyone with felony theft, they're on the record as having fled to a felony theft. But because of the extenuating circumstances of the crime, it's later become a gross misdemeanor or a misdemeanor. How would that be affected in this case with this bill?
Mr. Chair, I've been on the job for 3 weeks now, and I've tried to research all of these issues. It is a complicated issue, as already been stated. I know that if it's a conviction, from my understanding, it's a stay of imposition, they've been adjudicated guilty, so that would show on the record. A stay of adjudication, which happens less often, I think may not go on the record. But as far as, you know, whether it would be show as a felony or a misdemeanor after the stay of imposition, after the conditions of probation have been met, I don't know that for sure. I guess a response would be that I would assume it would still be the same type of crime. So a gross misdemeanor theft versus a felony theft, I think an employer would still look at that pretty closely if they were worried about honesty of the employee.
Well, and thank you, Mr. Hasse. The reason I ask is, and I know it represents close of the question too, is I think this is pretty important because we enact this policy at the state level up here at the Capitol and expect that it's going to be implemented with a blanket approach, but all the negotiating in the courtroom when it happens is very different based upon what we think the laws are up here at any given time. And a lot of times defense attorneys are attempting to craft deals for their clients based on whether or not it's going to be on their record, and they'll go back and say, you know what, yeah, you plead into a gross, but it's going to be a misdemeanor later on. Well, the client's saying, what does that mean for me? Does it matter? Because if I plead to a gross misdemeanor theft, a gross misdemeanor fraud or check forgery, and it becomes a misdemeanor because I, the state, have a problem proving it or something, so we'll not object to say then, it won't even matter for the guy in the end. So I think that's an important thing to examine as we look at this over the summer. So, Representative Colt.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. I think Mr. Hasse, when he was explaining Subdivision 2 of the bill, he referred to it as a step up in defense and a defense or whatever. But I think that's understating what it actually does. I mean, it's immunity from civil liability. And I'm not even saying that's wrong, necessarily. I think this is an issue that needs some further exploration. I mean, if we're going to tell an employer they can't look, maybe we shouldn't hold them civilly liable if they could have looked and found out. Maybe that makes complete sense, but it's more than just a step up. I mean, the way that the bill is drafted right now, it's immunity from civil liability. So, if we're going to go down this road, let's do it without, you know, kind of understating what it is we're trying to do. And again, I'm not saying we shouldn't go there. I think if we're going to do what's in Subdivision 1, we need to give serious consideration to whether we should be doing what's proposed in Subdivision 2. But that's a significant relief for private employers, and again, maybe very appropriate, but it's more than just a step on.
Representative Mulry.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Colt, I also think that I think it's, and I have not gone back and looked at 36403. Maybe you have. Matt hasn't. But I'm not sure that Subdivision 2 just is limited by Subdivision 1 or if it applies to other parts of a criminal record. So I see that as another problem, Mr. Chair, with this bill, in that it may be that Subdivision 2 is much broader than we are doing in Subdivision 1. I'm not sure. Maybe Mr. Gearing could.
Mr. Gearing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mulder, I guess that, are you referring to Subdivision 2 of the bill or 36403?
Subdivision 2 of the bill. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, yeah, I think that's correct. That it's
much
a little bit broader
than Subdivision 1. So we would be giving them exemption from liability for even convicted things, apparently. It looks like to me, Mr. Chair, and so I think there's some real problems with the way the bill is drafted.
Can you respond to that,
Mr. Hotsey?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, the version in the Senate, we did change the language more precisely to call it an affirmative defense instead of civil liability immunity. And then, correct, the intent with Subdivision 2 is that that would include conviction records, not just arrest records. That's when I started out, I said it's real important to sort of look at these separately because they are worded separately.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman, now that I realize what that, I would definitely not pursue this as a bill as an author with that broad interpretation. I don't think. I think that's going way too far to allow a private employer to hire somebody who is an axe murderer and has been convicted several times of it and then release them from liability for putting them and others in danger.
Well, Representative Mulready, that's why we're having this informational hearing, and as I stated, the bill will be laid over at the end of this hearing, but it's something that I anticipate you can work with throughout the interim, and obviously you have rather acute opinions on the direction of these expungement deals, Representative Mulready, and other people do as well, so perhaps that can be hashed out in the interim. If there are any other questions or any other testimony from Mr. Hotsey, I would ask for testimony from members of the audience. If you're here right now, please step forward, state your name for the record, who you represent. Mr. Horner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jack Horner, representing Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. Thoughtful discussion. I just want to state to make clear that in the rental housing business, of course, we do hire people. We hire on-site people. We hire people who manage properties. So I agree that the bill does not include screening for tenancy, but we also screen for employers. Employees, people who are charged with very important positions, people who have access to other people's apartments, people who are responsible for keeping the buildings running properly. So that is an important aspect. I'm responding to the bill, of course, as before you, as introduced, and it raises these issues. Cities and our state law put a lot of pressure on landlords to keep their buildings running properly. A lot of cities have licensing ordinances. Landlords can literally lose their right to run buildings if their properties are not run properly. You can get a notice from a city official, a police officer, or a city official saying, we've heard of a problem, and you literally, the landlord is required to take action right then and there, and action usually means an eviction, based on no convictions, of course, just a citation, a ticket, a police complaint, a police record. A lot of police and a lot of cities work with landlords. They'll give you lists of problems that have occurred at your building so that landlords can keep on top of these things. Our state nuisance law doesn't require any kind of a conviction to force a landlord to have to take action against a nuisance action. Just a complaint is enough. So these are important issues. It's already been alluded to that there are a lot of cases, and I had prepared to have instances, but they've already been explored about cases where people have had numerous arrests. I was at a community meeting in South Minneapolis several years ago now, where the police officer had a list of some 90 arrests of a fella, no convictions. Couldn't get them, you know, because these drug dealers, they're clever, they know how to hide things, they know what to do, so, but it's not the kind of person that you would want running your apartment, on the other hand, either. Finally, one point that occurred to me, that the bill will allow adverse action, which I guess includes by a current employer, if the non-conviction action, the arrest, complaint, or citation is pending. And I'm not sure how you would know that or what that means. And that's been discussed at some length, so I won't explore it further. But, I mean, geez, a charge could come a long time from now. I mean, how do you know? So we just want to go on record as saying that because we are employers as well, in the version before you, and I stress that the situation and that we do have these concerns. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Horner. Any questions? Do you have a question? For
no.
Okay, I do have a question for you, Mr. Horner.
Thank you.
And it's along the lines of the same question that I asked of Mr. Hasse as it relates to when a fee was entered on the record and therefore a conviction exists on the record for this individual defendant, but a stay of imposition, for example, was granted by the court, and therefore a felony theft or gross misdemeanor theft becomes one level lower, say now it's misdemeanor, and perhaps you're in a position where the market dictates that, you know, we'll hire people with, you know, old misdemeanor thefts, but, you know, no felony thefts. I know your position as an organization is going to be to say, well, no, wait a second, we want all the information we can get at any time. But do you think there's an appropriate line to be drawn at some point as policymakers here in this subcommittee that we should draw if, in fact, there should be a difference between various levels of crime?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. A good question. I think that our members probably would tend to do that or would have some... To some extent, they would do that because the point was made, for example, well, what about a traffic violation? But I think it's important that the information be before the landlord. I think it's important that the landlord be able to make that decision based on location of his property, the clientele of his property. Let me just briefly, very briefly, give two examples. Back when I practiced law, I had one client who ran a property for people recovering from alcoholism, recovering alcoholics. It was very important, and I have these people draft their documents and so on. It was extremely important that no one ever be allowed to get into the building carrying a bottle of liquor with them. I mean, it'd be like a bomb, the woman who ran the building said, if someone ever got a bottle of liquor and invited his buddies in. I mean, it'd be a terrible thing for them and for that program and for that building. So you might want to be very careful about certain kinds of arrests, convictions, complaints, citations. Another property that I represented was folks who ran for vulnerable adults, seniors and vulnerable, the assisted housing. Some of these people had terrible medical conditions, very vulnerable. One fellow wore the brace around his neck because he had severe injuries. And the point is they're all very vulnerable. You'd want to be very, very careful that people you're screening as employees and have access to these folks are very careful to do the job right. So again, I think it would depend at that time on the age of the conviction, the type of the conviction. I think it's important that the landlord be able to make that judgment, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Horner. Any other questions for Mr. Horner? Actually, no. So are there any other testifiers to Ripter and Mullery's House File 3407 as not amended? In the audience who wish to come forward? Okay. Seeing none, then, the chair lays over House File 3407. And there being no other business in front of the committee, the subcommittee is adjourned.